Welcome back to another episode of the Bronx Attorney Broadcast, a podcast that hasn't come out in about a year and a half now. But we'll see if we can get it going again. Today we have Michael Solomon. Michael is a former assistant district attorney for Kings County. He was recently promoted to senior trial counsel at Smiley and Smiley LLP. Former chair of the Associate Board of Directors for the New York State Academy of Trial Lawyers and current board member. Welcome, Michael. How are we doing today?
Thank you, Will. Thanks for having me, and glad we're able to kick this podcast back up again.
I feel like we have a lot of good conversations, off air, we'll call it, and we should put some of them, record some of them, so that we can some of these ideas can be saved.
Absolutely.
So the first thing that I wanted to talk to you about is I know that you transitioned from assistant district attorney to plaintiff's attorney. Now, when you were leaving the district attorney's office, had you had any personal injury experience before that?
I had no experience whatsoever. In fact, I Googled personal injury firms in New York City when I was looking to make the transition and looked at one firm, saw the attorneys, and some of them were former ADAs. So I cold called the firm and asked to speak to the managing partner for a job. And they thought it was crazy. And then after the conversation, they said, "We're not hiring, but why don't you send me your resume?" And I sent my resume the next day and wound up getting an email back saying that the managing partner wanted to meet with me. And the journey started in my searching for the next job, and wound up interviewing for that firm, and then got put in touch with Smiley and Smiley for another interview. So I wound up having two interviews without knowing any firms, and then finally decided on Smiley and Smiley. So I didn't really know how to spell personal injury, let alone handle, the civil world. So it was a good adjustment, but it was a leap of faith too.
How do you market yourself and convince somebody that you're going to make a good personal injury attorney when, you don't have any experience in that field before?
Well, I was a prosecutor for 5 years, so I was hoping that I could take some trial skills, litigation skills, advocacy skills, and just interpersonal skills and kind of parlay that into the next job. In addition to having the skills, I think you need to be, we're counselors, attorneys and counselors, and you need to be able to work with and for people. And especially when you're a plaintiff's attorney and you get paid at the back end and you do the work up front, you have to put your game face on and you have to instill confidence in the clients to let them know that you're ready, willing, and able to help them every step of the way. And I think everything I learned from the DA's office and dealing with severe, heinous crimes and victims who were really going through something traumatic and now transitioning into personal injury and doing severe and catastrophic injury. The skills and the feeling is very similar. So I think, just with all of that said, to keep the momentum going and instilling confidence in the clients.
So it sounds like it was you could work well with the clients and you had the trial experience. What about the learning the practice of personal injury? How was that transition for you?
Well, it was interesting because I resigned March 13, 2020, and started March 16, 2020 at Smiley and Smiley. And Guy Smiley, the founding partner of the firm, handed me a laptop and a legal pad on my first day, and then the world shut down. So it was pretty interesting going from public to private, and then going from starting a brand new job to you're going to be now remote, and we're going to have to teach you as you go along. And Andrew, Guy, Jason really took me under their wings, and it was a lot of learning through phone calls or Zoom meetings and listening to Jason, one of the partners at the firm, kind of handle an intake, and I'd stay on the phone. And then it would transition into, okay, you're going to handle the intake, and Jason was going to stay on the phone and then monitor the call and fill in questions that I might have missed. And then going over it with Jason, I progressed to, "Hey, I'm going to handle the call, and if there's any questions, I'll run it by Jason, after the phone call." To now I handle the majority of the intakes that come through the firm. So it's just trial and error, but I think again, being a prosecutor and thinking on your feet and having those skills helped transition me into an interesting time when the world shut down, and being able to learn not only a new job, but a new area of law, and following up with the Trial Academy and the CLEs that they had to offer definitely helped pave the way.
And I think that's a good thing to learn is that, you're never going to know everything. So to be comfortable being able to say to somebody like a client that calls in, I'm not so sure about, what the law is in that area or, what your exact circumstances would result in. So let me do some research and get back to you with a really good answer. Or, let me talk to somebody who has a really great knowledge in there and get a better answer for you is a powerful thing that some people are uncomfortable doing.
Yeah, and I work for a firm, Smiley and Smiley, that's been around since 1968. So 60, almost 60 years of experience, they're still learning things every day. So taking from that and seeing that people with a firm that's been around for decades and they're still learning things, it's like you have to be open to understanding. You're not going to know everything, and you're going to learn as much as you can along the way. And it's what you do with that information that you know, and also not being afraid to tell a client, I don't know the answer, but let me try and find that out for you. Because I think when you are honest with a client, that kind of strengthens the confidence and the relationship that you have with them.
Yeah, and the law's changing all the time too, right? We see major changes in the law, whether it's in the statutes themselves or in the Court of Appeals changing the law, and then having to get caught back up on what the new law is.
Yeah, and then educate the client. Like the dog bite law just recently changed this year, and have a dog bite case and have you explain to the client, okay, the change in law and what this means, and basically the game plan moving forward based on that law. So you have to stay up with the times and then use that information to help guide the client. So it's a forever learning process, and I'm still learning.
Yeah, and it seems like you got caught up to speed in a tremendously fast amount of time because in just about 5 years you were promoted to senior trial counsel. So congratulations on that.
Thank you, thank you.
And so what comes with that now? Are you going to be, really when cases are ready for trial, you start get running with that right away?
Well, yeah, I mean, Andrew Smiley is the lead, managing partner, the lead trial attorney. So he'll get to pick and choose, but the majority of the cases I will be trying as lead counsel. Unless there's a few cases that he wants to try, he needs to try. But knowing that I'll be either a good second seat or he'll throw me in the first chair and I'm ready to roll.
Yeah. And so was it, you just had a recent trial. Were did you have that title before your trial or was that something that came after?
It came after. In fact, I won't bore you with all the details. You can stay tuned for a follow-up episode. But there was a massive ski case that our firm had last year. So I got the second seat and did a witness, but played a lot of a big role behind the scenes and helping with the logistics and the laptop and the presentations and the in that respect. But yeah, I had before that, I didn't try a case since an attempted murder in 2019. That was the last case I tried at the DA's office. And then March of 2020 was when the world shut down, so trials were few and far between. So it was funny that this trial that I just had was the first time that my boss, who hired me to try cases, was then able to experience me as a first chair and see what I got.
Yeah, and that's a very strange circumstance to be in where you're the lead attorney on the trial and your boss, the managing partner of your firm, is the second chair. So what was that experience like?
It was great. I mean, he was a fantastic second seat. I couldn't have dialed it up better. He gave me the ball and said, go with it. And I was happy to have that. And it was a great experience. Andrew and I get along really well, and we have similar minds with trial. And, it basically just had the framework. I've never picked a jury. In civil court and in criminal in Brooklyn is much different than being thrown into a room in New York County and saying, here's a stack of cards and figure it out with your adversary. So it was just a lot of scratch my head moments, but knowing that Andrew is there for his experience and his expertise along the way. And I think even Andrew helped assist with the defense counsel. We weighed in on some things, and Andrew was kind of like the voice of reason and said, I think that this is the best way to proceed for everyone. So we were taking his advice along the way, which I thought was helpful and comforting, and, you know, checking with co-counsel in between, before I finish my line of questioning, making sure that going over impeachment and putting exhibits into evidence and just the overall decorum and buttoning your jacket when you stand up and asking, you know, professionalism within the courtroom, Your Honor, may I do this? Madam Court Reporter, you know, court officer, may I approach the witness? So those things were something that Andrew was not only looking for, but expecting, and to be able to deliver that was great.
Yeah. And there's so much different procedure in trial that you might not be used to, because when we see judges all the time, it's, you know, might be conferences or something that's a lot more informal, where you're not really getting that, that same experience. So I know that I've had that feeling before, where I'm forgetting to do things, or, you know, I'm catching myself, oh, that's right, where I have to, you know, say something for the record or ask permission to do something in this special circumstance. So I know you had a tricky case, one that I don't think you had any offer from the defendants on before your trial, right?
Absolutely. So this was a unique situation. It was a 2020 accident. It was a assault at a construction site, where one of the subcontractor's employees assaulted the general contractor's site safety supervisor. So the only charge, the only cause of action that was remaining after motion practice was negligent hiring, training, and supervision on the job site. So the tortfeasor, the assailant, was in the wind. We had a default judgment against him. So the only defendant in play was the assailant's employee, the subcontractor, for the negligent hiring, supervision, and training. So for 5 years, there was a no-pay position. We went through a few court mediations to no avail, some pretrial conferences, and even the judge from the trial during motions in limine tried to advocate to get a resolution. And then even at the end of the trial, after summations, is when the judge called us up and said, are you guys really not going to look to resolve this case? And, you know, we said, Your Honor, we've been hearing the same song for the last 5 years, so we don't believe there's any reason to think otherwise. And the judge was the one that recommended and was trying to put pressure on defense to say, call your carrier and see if they're willing to do this. It's the 11th hour. The jury has the case. And the judge was actually the one that had recommended there was a $1 million high and a $200,000 low. So if anyone doesn't understand how a high low works, is you basically agree to those parameters. The low is 200. So if a verdict was to come in for the defense, so if we lost, or if a number was returned by the jury awarding my client a number less than 200, we had downside protection locked in at the 200. If there was a verdict that was in excess of the million, we were capped at the million, and any number between 200,000 and 1 million was the number that would be decided.
And generally, when you were coming into this trial, the defendant's position was that this person who committed the assault was a rogue actor. There was no way that they could have, you know, seen this coming, even though they had oversight over him. It was totally, you know, with outside the scope of his employment, and it was just, you know, they couldn't have done anything to prevent this from happening, right?
Correct. You know, it came down to notice. Did the subcontractor's employer have notice that the employee was, in fact, violent and had vicious propensities to commit such violent acts on the job site? And if the subcontractor had notice, then we can prove it. If they didn't have notice, and that's what the defense's basic theory of the case was, that they had no notice, he's a day laborer, you know, there wasn't much of an interview process, and day laborers, stuff happens on construction sites, and cursing and people fighting or arguing, and it's a hostile environment, and therefore the subcontractor, there was no way that they could be liable.
And at what stage in the trial was it that you made you this idea to have this sort of high-low arrangement come into play?
Well, the arrangement came into play literally after the summation. It was, you okay? I think we lost you for a sec. Great. It came after summation. So the jury was charged the case. They're in the back deliberating, and that's when the judge called us up to try and work out a resolution. And it was, in fact, the judge that was able to get this done to have us, you know, both sides to come to the agreement to the high low. And lo and behold, once we entered into the high low, we put the plaintiff, you know, on the record, and he allocated to knowing exactly what he was agreeing to. And you can't make this up. Literally after we put it on the record, the judge said, okay, you know, we took a deep breath, told the client that they're going to leave with guaranteed money. And next thing you know, the court officer told us that the jury returned the verdict. So
wow.
it was bang, bang.
So what was it that came out during the trial when you were presenting your evidence that you think caused the defendants to go from the no pay position to agreeing to this settlement agreement where they're putting at least $250,000 into your client's pocket, or, you know, agreeing to a verdict of at least $250,000?
200, the low is 200. So I think the first thing, and I'm sorry for blanking, is that we mucked it up, that we were able to present evidence, whether it was persuasive or not, that if the employer was there, then they would have been able to supervise to see what was going on. And it seemed like the project manager was never there, and things that were being observed by other employees of the subcontractor who observed this stuff, no one was reporting. There was no chain of command. And then I think the other thing, which is now I'm remembering, is the jury got the case on a Thursday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and didn't come back until then. The judge dismissed them for the evening at like 5:30. And then it wasn't until the next day that the jury came back to deliberate and continue to deliberate for an hour. And it was in that hour that we were able on Friday morning that we were then able to enter the high low. The high low is entered right before the verdict. So I think, as you'll learn as a plaintiff's attorney, the longer the time is for when the jury is deliberating, that's usually a better sign for the plaintiff because there's a lot of questions on the jury verdict sheet. So I think that the longer the time is, you would think that the jury had already decided liability, because if the first question is no, then you're done. Right. If the next question is no, then you're done. So I think the fact that the jury was able to continue deliberating put some pressure on defense to say, hey, this isn't just a quick turnaround. Now I think they're talking about money, and I think we should get some downside protection or upside protection cap.
Right. And so it sounds like you were able to show through, like, how did you show that if the people were there who were employees of the company that were the supervisors, if they were there, they would have seen that this guy had some sort of violent tendencies? How did you establish that? Or how did you argue that?
So through, and it was hard because, you know, and you even opined on it before, as I was preparing for the trial, there was an affidavit that we had from a foreman on the job who worked for the subcontractor, who was the quote unquote supervisor when the project manager for the subcontractor was not on the job site. And we were able to present evidence. We weren't able to get the affidavit in, but through supporting testimony from our client who interacted with the foreman, who were always on the job site, who were in close proximity to all of the plaintiff's experiences, showcasing the defendant's violent propensities or, you know, aggressive hostile behavior, that corroborated exactly what happened. And if those foremen who were on the job that observed everything did in fact observe everything, then why weren't they properly supervising and therefore they were negligent? So that was, you know, the strongest way and the only way in which we were able to present that evidence to support the case.
And isn't there no more anxious feeling that you get than when you hear that court officer come in and they say the jury has a verdict? What was going through your mind when you heard that?
Well, it's definitely and being a prosecutor too, and hearing we have a verdict, that blood rushing through your body and that empty feeling in your stomach. In this case, it was kind of playing with house money because I wasn't expected to win. It was an uphill battle. It was a no pay position, and it was just kind of one of those cases where the only way out was through the trial. So I was nervous because I wanted to do well for the client and I wanted to do well for my first solo trial with the firm. But I threw it all out on the table. So at the end of the day, it wasn't up to me. And as nervous as I was, I felt we put the best case forward, and it was nervous energy, but also excited to see what the jury was going to return, because after 5 years, it was like, all right, I want the answer already.
And what was the verdict that the jury came back with?
So the jury found that the defendant was negligent in their supervision. However, and I'll explain little brief facts just to give some insight, because I do think that the verdict was, I think the jury's thought process to get to the verdict was correct, and I respect it. So what happened is, on the date of the attack, the defendant had assaulted the plaintiff, with a piece of rebar, and threw him to the ground and started beating him up and cracked him across the back. And he sustained injuries to his lumbar spine during that immediate attack. And then what happened is, the employees of the company were able to remove temporarily the defendant and restrain him, to the point where my client was then able to get to his feet and get outside of the construction site to make a call to his supervisor. And then, 911 was called. But at the same time, as my client was outside making a phone call, he turns around after the phone call, and who's in his face but the defendant again, and whops him in the face, cracks him across the face, and winds up breaking his nose. So what had happened was, the jury found that there was no way that the company could have had notice of the defendant's vicious propensities. They essentially weren't buying our argument throughout the trial that there was notice before the first attack. However, the jury determined that the negligence of the supervision was in between the first attack and the second attack. So why didn't the company step in at that point when they had noticed that their employee just assaulted the GC's supervisor and then therefore did nothing? So the jury found that the negligence happened in between the first attack and the second attack, which was probably minutes, but those minutes definitely helped get us the win.
And were you able to talk to the jurors and you got that information from them, or is that something that you're kind of just hypothesizing?
No, this is right from the horse's mouth. We were able to speak to the jury after. They sat and took a, it was a pleasant experience. They sat in the jury box, and we asked, me and my adversary asked them questions. And it was during the summer, so there were a ton of interns, and they were interested from, interning for the court. And the jury had questions for us in terms of strategy and style and whatnot. So it was a good back and forth with the jury, which is something you don't often get, but I do agree. So the crazier part is, the jury determined, since there was no since there was no notice for the first attack, that they disregarded all of the injuries to that he sustained to his lumbar spine. So they only returned a damage award for the injuries he sustained in the second attack, which was the broken nose.
And what was the number that they came back with?
So I have my notes up here. That's why I'm looking on the other page. But so it's 25,000 for past pain and suffering, 100,000 for future pain and suffering. They gave him back his medical bills that defense and I had stipulated to, which were $23,822. And then for future medical care and costs, they gave him an $125,000 award. So all of that round equaled $273,822
Okay,
for a
great.
broken nose.
Is there one thing or a few things that you would say was your biggest takeaway from this experience, or maybe something that you learned, or maybe is going to affect the way that you try cases in the future?
Yeah, I definitely think that our expert doctor on the damages was great. And his report was great. I think that the jury just thought that the numbers were a little too inflated. And I think defense kind of brought that out on cross-examination to really make the jury think. So I think maybe just on a case by case, even if the expert is giving numbers, it's okay to maybe work with the expert to dial those numbers back if you think that it may upset the jury in a way, which I did during summation say, hey, those are the numbers that the expert explained. Those are his numbers, not my numbers and not your numbers. You feel free to give him more than what the expert said or even give him less. You know, I hedged and said you could give him less. But the jury ultimately still paid out. And, you know, with the help of our expert, they still paid out $125,000 in future medical care and costs for a broken nose. So definitely, it's a you got to take the good and the bad with it.
Yeah, and I think that for the average person, it might just be hard to wrap their head around just how much doctors charge for treatment. And they might never see it if they have, good insurance or something like that.
Exactly. And we had two medical professionals. We had, two medical professionals on the jury. And we actually had a project manager for a for NBC Universal. So we had some interesting and intelligent jurors who were able to use their experience to help round out the verdict and the awards.
Well, congratulations on the result and congratulations on all the good stuff going on in your career right now. I'll be following the next trial that you're doing for sure. Before we log off here, do you want to tell anybody about, where they can find you, contact information if they want to hire you?
Sure. Go to Smiley and Smiley, smileylaw.com. You see my information on my background. You can also check out the Mentor ESQ. That's Andrew Smiley's mentorship program. I don't know when this is coming out, but you still have an opportunity to register and sign up for Andrew's mentor program for 2026. So definitely take advantage. I know you took advantage of that program and hopefully
Yep, I
you found a
did.
lot of benefit
For
from
sure.
it. And you know, just a little plug about the firm, you know, Smiley and Smiley, like I said, we've been around since 1968. We specialize in severe and catastrophic injury and medical malpractice. And interesting enough, the last few years, we've expanded to create another division of our firm with risk and coverage. So if you have a disclaimer, if you have a reservation of rights, if you have a carrier that disclaims and denies coverage, but there's ample coverage, there's liability, and there's good injuries, that's definitely a new area that our firm has been thriving and helping other plaintiffs' firms handle those cases to try and get the insurance back into the case so that they can resolve their cases.
All right, well, thanks for doing this. I enjoyed hearing about the trial, and I'll see you soon.
Thank you so much, Will. Be well.